Welcome to the July 24th, 2017 edition of Sidebar. This is Unconcluded, a real-time investigation into the disappearance of Jennifer Kessie. I'm your host, Sean Gerd.
And I'm your co-host, Scott Jameson.
In this episode, we're going to respond to all your comments and questions about Episode 7 and the interaction that Flo believes that she had with Jennifer Kessie at the Huntington on the Green. We'll also touch on some other things along the way.
Okay, let's go ahead and get started with our voicemails.
Hi, my name is Danielle. I have been following Jennifer Kessie's story for a long time, ever since it was in the news. I actually happened to be living in Tampa when it happened, and I remember it coming across the news where I was living, and it really struck me because we actually went to elementary school with her in Virginia a long time ago, and my whole family remembers her and her family because I guess my brother had a crush on her and stuff growing up in elementary school because she was so pretty and all the boys liked her. And anyways, I don't remember when they moved from Virginia, but my parents remember her family as well, so our whole family's followed her story ever since she went missing. And I just found your podcast, so I just started listening, but I think it's great. And actually, our whole family started listening, and we've been talking about it. I do just have a question about your recently aired episode and the woman who thinks she saw Jennifer in her parking lot. I'm sure you've discussed this with her, but has she been able to confirm the man in the video, if that's the man that she saw, dragging her or whatever in the parking lot? And she described the man with the ponytail and loose clothing. It obviously sounds like the man who was in the video. Has she confirmed that that was him? That just was the first thing that came to my mind. So I was just wondering if you knew. And also, if anybody's looked into the complex, the community, to see if they checked the video footage from the entire day, or if they had looked at previous footage to see if this man was in any of the cameras at any other hours of today, whether it was past or present from the time the car was parked. Anyways, just a couple thoughts. I think you guys are doing a great job. We love the podcast, and can't wait to keep listening. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Danielle. To answer the second part first about the cameras, as we've mentioned, the police have kept the details of their investigation under wraps. So in answering questions about what they may or may not have done, a lot of the time that's involving us taking a few different statements that they've made over the years and kind of applying them to questions at hand. In this particular case, you are asking about if the police have looked at the footage prior to the POI or for the whole day. And I do believe that to be the case. As far as what's on the tape itself, I do think that the police have looked it over. But keep in mind that these types of security camera systems will tape over previous footage after a set period of time, so there would have been a limit to how far back they were able to go. All that said, and although I'm sure that they've looked at it, what they found, we just don't know. The part that's been released, of course, is the video we've all seen. And as I mentioned back in episode 3, and I think this is still the case, I believe that there's video that we haven't seen, that the public hasn't seen. But what might be on that video, we can only really just speculate at this point. As for the first part of your question, if Flo thinks that she saw the POI, she just doesn't know. As you're well aware, the footage of the POI is pretty bad, and I just don't think there was enough there for Flo to make a determination about the man she saw. There wasn't anything in the video that made her say, yes, that's him, if that makes sense.
Hi, this is Kim from Houston, Texas. There's just something that I've been thinking about since a couple episodes ago when we covered the suspects, and you talked about Jennifer Kessie's ex-boyfriend drinking at a bar next door to where her condo was located, and I just can't seem to shake that I feel like he must have saw her that night. Whether he had anything to do with her disappearance or not, I really do think that they made contact that night somehow, because, I mean, there were reports of him possibly still being in love with her, and I feel like if you're walking distance from your ex, when you're drunk, you're probably going to go over there and say something, whether it be ill intention or not. I just feel like, how many times have we heard that story of someone getting drunk and contacting their ex? So I was just wondering if you guys had any idea of any text messages from him or calls from him on Jennifer's phone that night, or if maybe he could come forward and say that he did go over there. Maybe he's scared to say that because he might be implemented, but it really just could be helpful information from him. Anyway, that's just something I've been thinking about. Thank you so much for doing this, and I really hope that we can get to the bottom of this. Thanks so much. Bye.
Kim, you bring up a good point. Based on the information that we've heard from Jennifer's mom and dad and various interviews about what the ex-boyfriend was apparently doing that night, it seems like a pretty real possibility that this individual could have contacted or attempted to contact Jennifer. But we just don't know. And if it is the case, then the next morning when she's reported missing, I think we can all understand why it might be a hard thing to admit because of the implications that it would surely support. All that said, I'm still hopeful, maybe even a little more now than a few weeks ago, that at some point we'll be able to rule out the ex completely and be able to focus the investigation without that distraction. But for now, questions like yours, they do remain.
Hi, this is Jennifer from Nashville, Tennessee. I just was wondering about, you mentioned that the dog scented back to Jennifer's apartment that overlooked some kind of a body of water, a pond or a bog of some sort. I was wondering if that body of water was ever looked at in conjunction, if it was dredged or anything for any possible clues. Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Jennifer. Yes, the body of water that you're referring to is a small residential pond that Jennifer's condo overlooked. And to answer your specific question, yes, based on the information I've looked at, that pond was searched, and it's pretty small. So I think it's probably safe to say that there wasn't anything of note found in that particular pond.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to call and thank you guys for the time and the effort that you've put towards the podcast so far. And I do have a few questions that I'm curious about. Number one, is it true that Jennifer's last call with her boyfriend occurred on her landline in her condo? Number two, I was wondering if you guys were at least aware of the info that is allegedly being withheld about Jennifer's cell pinging on towers away from her condo just before 11 p.m. on the 23rd. It's not info that you guys can really authenticate, but I wanted to get your guys' thoughts. And then number three, Jennifer gave her brother a set of keys to her condo while she was away. Were those the same keys Logan used to access Jennifer's condo on the 24th? And number four, Jennifer had an alarm system apparently, and it was disabled for Logan and his friends. But I read that the alarm didn't go off when Logan accessed the condo on the 24th. Does her family find it unlikely that she wouldn't have taken the time to enable it before she left for work on the 24th. That's it. Thanks for all the hard work. Bye.
Thanks for the voicemail. Up front, let me go ahead and say that some of these questions have already been covered on the podcast, either in regular episodes or on sidebar episodes. However, I do understand that there's a lot of info and it can be challenging to keep it all organized. So let me take this opportunity to again recommend our Facebook discussion group. There are some listeners who have taken their own time to create documents outlining information and frequently asked questions that are pretty valuable. For example, the information about Jennifer's alarm. We've heard from Joyce Kessie on the podcast about the fact that while Jennifer's condo had a wall panel, the alarm wasn't actually in service or used by her. So come on over and check out the group and the FAQs, and if there's still some questions or things that you're unsure of, you can also start a discussion right in the group itself. Just search for Unconcluded Podcast Discussion Group right on Facebook.
That'll wrap up the voicemails for this sidebar. Let's go ahead and move on to our social media and email portion of the show. Sean says, so if we were to believe this account and the one at the roundabout, some guy was driving all around with her before she disappeared? Just trying to work out how this fits into the narrative.
This question, I assume, is talking about Flo's account from Huntington on the Green and the other encounter from Northbridge Apartments and how they fit together. My answer to that would be that I don't think we're ready to put these two separate accounts together yet into one narrative. For one, the description of the man is different. And because of the time difference between the two accounts, which I think would be something like 15 hours, in putting them together, we have a big chunk of missing time that we have to deal with that could be speculated on in a million different ways. Some listeners have come up with some various theories that do have possibilities, including Jennifer possibly being held at the Huntington on the Green after being abducted at Northbridge, but we just don't have anything at this time to tie these two events together other than both witnesses saying that they saw Jennifer. There have been others who say that these two accounts contradict each other and can't both involve Jennifer, and that line of thinking makes sense as well. If you want to know my opinion, and you didn't ask for it, but I'll give it anyways, I think it's unlikely that both these accounts are actually Jennifer. But that said, both witness statements are pretty compelling for their own reasons.
Kimberly has several questions. Do you want to go ahead and take these one at a time?
Yep, go for it.
Okay. Her first question is, what did Flo think was the height of the man with the person she thinks is Jennifer?
We actually asked Flo to clarify this because we wanted to make sure that we had it correct. If you remember, in the original audio, she had mentioned that the girl was a little bit taller than she was, and she is 5'4". Here's what she had to say about how tall the man was.
He looked like maybe the same size or a little bit shorter than she was.
So the best that we can do is say that the girl and the man were about the same height, which was taller than 5'4".
She also wants to know, did other apartments or condos in the area follow the practice of letting workers stay in unoccupied units? And she especially wants to know if this relates to Huntington on the Green and Northbridge.
While this practice is not completely unheard of, in this particular case, if we're talking about Northbridge and Huntington on the Green, both of those particular complexes were completely finished for the most part and wouldn't have had long-term construction workers that needed to stay in the apartments anyways. So I think that we can go ahead and say that that was not the case at both of those particular complexes.
All right, the next one from Kimberly. Were the batteries of the cell phones found, and is that why they knew that they had been removed?
No, the batteries have never been found, along with the phones. The only thing that we know is that law enforcement said that presumably the batteries were removed, and that's just based on the fact that the phones were no longer pinging. Could there be a different explanation? The phone being crushed or broken or thrown into water? Probably.
Also from Kimberly, were the empty condos or those occupied by the workers in her complex searched, and was her condo ever processed by detectives?
Law enforcement did search other units and storage closets at the Mosaic. Now, we've heard some rumors that some units were unable to be searched because the owners couldn't be contacted, but that's never been confirmed. As far as Jennifer's condo itself, no, it was never processed by law enforcement, which is completely absurd. There's just no good excuse for that to happen.
Dana asks, where in the parking lot did Flo see this blonde woman and man with a ponytail? Was it near Jennifer's parked car or in a different area? Also, she wants to define what quote-unquote close to the case means.
The location of Flo's interaction isn't very far from the location of where Jennifer's car was parked. It would have been past that area on the northern side of a little circle of parking spaces that's deeper into the parking lot behind the pool. She saw the woman and man walking from the sidewalk which leads into the center of the buildings back out towards the pool area. And yes, we've considered if that could have been captured on the pool camera. But without knowing exactly where they continued walking to, I don't think that we can determine whether it would be on there or not. But the angle of the camera that was pointed towards Jennifer's car was really bad. The POI from that camera is simply a small white speck. So I think regardless, expecting this camera to be able to pick up anything from people who would have been even farther away is probably just unrealistic.
Continuing with Dana's questions, Sean, you mentioned that you questioned this person and that they do not remember saying this to Flo. Does this not cast major doubt on Flo's witness account?
Actually, quite the opposite. The person didn't say that they don't remember having a conversation or talking to Flo about it, simply that they just didn't remember why they would have told her that it was mistaken identity. In fact, this person actually helped put us in touch with Flo in the first place, and didn't question or cast doubt on Flo's statements at all.
Adam says, is there more info about the lookalike prostitute out there? Has anyone ever interviewed or spoke with her about the case? Not implying that she has anything to do with it, I'm just curious about this.
There actually isn't a whole lot of info. I believe that I've determined who this person is. Maybe not 100%, but I have a strong suspicion that I have the right person. And we are working on contacting her, but at this point, we have yet to do so.
Tammy has some questions for Flo. Were there other people outside at the time who may have also seen the blonde woman? Did she have any interaction with the man who she was with? What was their demeanor? Did the woman seem frightened? Was the man nervous about speaking with her?
Flo says that there really wasn't anyone else around that she remembers. She also says that she remembers the woman not really being scared, but just kind of trying to talk to her and then being ushered away by the man. Her description of the man was simply, he looked angry. She really doesn't have a whole lot other to add because she said the interaction was so brief that she really didn't get a sense of anything else other than the expressions on their faces.
Another question from Bethany. Why didn't the Kesseys hire a private investigator? Or did they?
They have not. Joyce Kessie actually told me about this several weeks ago, and I had never really had a chance to share it on the podcast, and I believe she answered a question on our Facebook group about this recently as well. The reason behind not hiring a private investigator is simply that the Orlando police consider this an act of investigation, and therefore they are unwilling to share information with any outside parties. So a private investigator wouldn't have any access to the information that they have, and so the Kesseys believe that it wouldn't be very fruitful for them to devote resources to a private investigator.
Erica has a question, and it's not exactly related to episode 7, but she wants to help herself rule out the popular construction worker theory. There's two parts to her question. First, she says that Jen lived in Mosaic for about 2 months. How many times in that time frame did her long-distance boyfriend, Rob, visit? Secondly, she says, I assume she visited family out of town for Thanksgiving, Christmas, maybe New Year's. Had overnight visits from her boyfriend, then had Logan, Travis, and Matt at the condo while she was in St. Croix. It just doesn't set the stage for a perfect crime by a laborer stalking her. Erica does not think that Jen was as predictable as we assume.
I would agree that maybe Jen wasn't as predictable as we assume, but I want to clarify a couple things. Joyce Kessie actually responded to some questions about this on our discussion group, and Jennifer moved into the Mosaic at Millennia on Thanksgiving in 2005, and at that point in time, I believe her family was there with her, and so she had only been in that condo for about 2 months. Her and her boyfriend would alternate weekends, so he would come to Orlando and she would go to Fort Lauderdale alternating weekends, so maybe that wasn't as predictable, but also remember that laborers or workers are typically going to be working during the week. So her weekly schedule may have been a lot more predictable than her weekend schedule, as you alluded to.
Christine asks, did the description of the man that Flo says she saw with Jennifer match the description of the man that was seen with Jennifer at Northbridge Apartments by Erica?
No, not really. They are both described as Hispanic. However, the Huntington on the Green individual had a ponytail, and the man that Erica says that she saw at Northbridge Apartments had a shorter crop-style haircut.
Shannon asks, I've heard that Jennifer had her table set for a dinner party the night she was reported missing. Do you know who was invited?
I actually asked Joyce about this because I really had never heard about it, and she says that Jennifer's table was actually still set from the Christmas holiday, and that she wasn't really planning to have a dinner party. So maybe some comments have been misinterpreted over the last decade or so. And this question actually also reminds me of another question that I had asked Joyce about what Jennifer may have done for dinner on the night of January 23rd. And Joyce said that there was food in the refrigerator and that Jennifer likely just, you know, used that food to make herself something for dinner that night. There was no takeout containers in the trash or anything like that.
Margaret wants to know, when the woman was saying hi, hello, etc. to Flo, was the man beside her or had she been separated from him? When he, quote-unquote, rushed her away, how did he do that? By grabbing or pulling her along? Did he ever have his hands on her?
Well, Scott, you asked her this when you talked to her, so I'm just going to go ahead and play your audio.
Did he grab her or touch her or anything
like
that?
No, he just looked at her and, you know, like said, they told her to come on or something like that. Or let's go. I don't remember what it was. He just kept on going. I think he was just more like a controlling influence because I don't remember. I mean, the way I would see it is you're walking with somebody and then you stop to say hello to somebody else, the other person might stop too, but he just kept on walking.
I know that audio was a little rough in parts, but basically what Flo was saying is that the man was not physical with the woman. It was more of just kind of a glance and maybe something under his breath to get her to go with him.
Okay, Adam has a couple of points. Did Jen typically put her hair up in a bun? Wasn't her hair rather short in length?
I'm glad somebody brought this up, because in the last episode, Flo at one point says that the girl she saw was wearing her hair in a bun, and then later also says it was in a ponytail. And so one of the things that we made sure that we asked her when we followed up was for her to clarify what the girl's hair looked like so that we could narrow that down.
It was straight hair, but I don't remember how long it was. All I remember was that her hair was pulled back. And I guess it wasn't a ponytail or a bun, but it was pulled back. So I just imagined that it was okay. A ponytail, but it was pulled back.
Okay, because you didn't get a real good look at the back of her head then? You just know that her hair was pulled back?
Yes, it was pulled back. I just imagined that it was a ponytail because it was pulled back. But 100% that it was a ponytail or a bun, that I'm not sure.
This was an important distinction to make because Joyce Kessie told us that Jenna never wore her hair in a bun. If she wore it up, it would always be just in a ponytail. So if Flo would have said it was a bun for sure, we might have been able to use that as evidence that it wasn't Jen. But as it stands now, where Flo's not really sure or doesn't really remember which one it was, it doesn't mean as much as it possibly could have.
That will wrap up our social media and email responses for this sidebar. We apologize to any that we didn't get to today. We'll try to get to them in the future. Thank you to everyone who sent in their thoughts and questions.
There's actually a bit more that we still need to get to on this sidebar. And so I'm going to try to run through some other information that I want to make sure that you guys have before this episode's done. First of all, we mentioned that we were going to show Flo photos of the person we believe was being mistaken for Jennifer back in 2006. And we did just that. Flo said that there was absolutely no way the photo is of the person that she saw. It wasn't even in question. So then we decided to send her another photo that included several people, one of which was Jennifer Kessie. And she said without a doubt the person that she saw was in fact Jennifer. She was able to pick her out of the photo. Now, obviously, after all the publicity of Jennifer's case, and the fact that she saw her on the news, and she knows what she looks like, it may not mean much. But we still wanted to make sure that she could confirm it. Two other things that I wanted to mention are some various rumors that have gone around for quite a while about the surrounding circumstances of Jennifer's disappearance. One of those rumors is that Jennifer's key fob was found in Windermere several years after her disappearance. But according to Joyce Kessie, those keys and key fob have never been found. So why that rumor was started in the first place, I have no idea. The second one is about a man's sweater that was located in Jennifer's hamper in her condo after her disappearance. And Joyce Kessie told me that that in fact is true. There was a sweater in her hamper that they don't know who it belonged to. Which, goes without saying, is pretty interesting. And it's a shame that the police didn't process her condo way back in 2006. There's a few other things that Joyce Kessie, Jennifer's mom, has shared over the past week or so. And we want to make sure that we keep everybody in the loop. When talking about the condo that was directly across from Jennifer's condo, it was actually unlocked when they went to inspect it after Jennifer disappeared. Logan, Jennifer's brother, and his friend actually went into that condo when they were looking for her. Its carpeting was removed, and it was in the process of being redone. The police did check it out, but Joyce doesn't really remember when. But it was not on January 24th. Also, some surrounding stores' surveillance cameras were checked, for example, the CVS and the Walgreens, but their security cameras faced their parking lots and not the street, so nothing really came of it. And remember when we mentioned that Jennifer's family suggested that she meet the coworker at a place that wasn't really considered romantic to let him know that she wasn't interested? Joyce says that happened in the cafeteria at her work. The last thing I want to leave you with is the fact that Joyce said Jennifer's towel, the one that we had discussed early in this podcast, the one that was still damp, was left hanging on the washing machine in a small laundry room with the door shut. And that might change some things as far as how long that towel might stay damp. A shut door is much different than an open room that has the air blowing. Just something to consider. That's going to wrap up our sidebar episode for today. I just want to take another moment to thank all of you who are along on this journey with us. Don't forget to like the podcast on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or Instagram. All of those are at UnconcludedPod. The Facebook discussion group, which I told you about earlier, continues to grow. We hope to see you in there soon. And if you're interested in supporting the podcast, you can click the support tab on unconcluded.com. And we also want to thank our new Patreon supporters, Jackie, Samantha, Kate, Angela, Aaron, Deborah, Jennifer, and Karen, as well as the Gone Cold podcast, which has just started and you can check out now. Every bit of help goes back into furthering our efforts to find answers. We'll be back in just about a week with episode 8, and we'll see you then.